You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. And welcome to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I'm your host, Professor Carlton Shieldchief Gover. And on this podcast, we're going to uncover the rich and fascinating histories of North America's Great Plains. Today, I am joined by Miss Jacqueline Sparks. Miss Sparks is the Director of Collections for the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma. And so today, we will be talking about just reviewing a movie that came out in 2012. By 2012, I meant 2022. Titled Prey. And the reason this came up is myself and Jacqueline, we watched this movie together recently to prep for my interview for the Screens of the Stone Age podcast. And that hour-long episode where I'm interviewed by two of their hosts, where we like do a deep dive into some of the Plains culture and like a quick movie review. You can go find them on screensofthestoneage.com/podcast. And their episode should already be out by the time this one comes out. And you can find them on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all the usual podcasting platforms. And they're an affiliate with the Archaeology Podcast Network. It's a little different, but I know they're affiliated with us. But I had a great time. But there's some things that we didn't cover on there that I thought would be good to bring Jacqueline on, because Jacqueline, you have a background in, you have a master's in fine arts, an MFA, and you've worked on movies before. So why don't you just give a quick introduction to yourself and your background to kind of set us up for the audience.
See you, everyone. As Carlton said, I am a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. And although I do work for the Chickasaw Nation, I'm just here as a private citizen talking to Carlton. But yeah, I have a Master of Fine Arts in Studio Art. I was a professional photographer for over a decade. And I also have worked on a number of Indigenous-led films. And so Prey is really one of my favorite movies, not just because it features so many great Indigenous actors, but also because there was a lot of thought and effort put into the filming of the movie, into the script writing, and to really center Indigenous storytelling in the 21st century.
Excellent. So what are some films that you've worked on in the past, just so people get an idea? Are you allowed to talk about films that you worked on? Like, of course, because you're in the credits, right?
I am in the credits, and I have an IMDb page, which I did not create for myself. Some poor studio assistant probably created it, and then other people have added to it. I worked on Teyada, Montford the Chickasaw Rancher. I've worked on several documentaries that I will surely butcher their names. But I've also worked on a number of short, like docu-series type things.
Gotcha. So right now on your IMDb, it just shows Teyada as...
Okay.
You're missing a couple of things in there. But
I was there for Montford almost every day of filming. I swear. I should probably see if I can add that.
I'm trying to remember. I don't think I've seen Teyada. What one's that one about?
So that features Koryanka Kilcher as the lead role. Teyada tells the story of the early life of a Chickasaw storyteller. It is a biography of her and her family. And midway through the film, we're introduced to the love of her life, Clyde Fisher, who is the founding curator at the Hayden Planetarium in New York.
Excellent. I see there's a white dog in there. Is that Ofutobi?
That is Ofutobi. Yeah. A number of Southeastern people have thoughts and about dogs in our stories. As Cherokee people, we talk about the Milky Way as the path where the dog ran. And then Chickasaw folks call the Milky Way the White Dog Way, or Ofutobi Okina.
Excellent. Well, thank you for sharing. That's great. So yeah, so you have some chops for reviewing films. And so today, like we mentioned at the top of this episode, we'll be looking at Prey 2020. Did I say 22 or 21?
I think it's 22.
I think it is 2022. So Prey, for those that aren't familiar with this movie, is a prequel to Predator with Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it is set in 1719 in the Northern Great Plains. It is filmed on a tribal territory in Canada. It follows a Comanche woman and her brother, some friends, and basically her hunting and gathering posse as they deal with aliens of two different varieties, European aliens and extraterrestrial aliens. So to kick us off, Jacqueline, what were some things that, when did you first watch this movie?
Oh, I think I watched it the weekend it came out. I think I remember watching it because it was a Hulu release. It was a home release. And this was like late in COVID, like lockdown times. But I remember being very excited about it. One of my dear friends, Carrie Myers, her aunt Jane Myers is the producer, and a number of her friends were crew on the film. And so from time to time, I was seeing social media posts of production. And so, like, I think the Native art world is already very small, but Indigenous film is even more small. And so I was like primed and ready to see about it. And then, of course, Hulu and Disney Plus did a great job promoting the film. I think, didn't it? It came out in the summer. It was like a summer release, wasn't it? It was like a Comic-Con premiere time, if I'm remembering correctly.
When did it drop? I don't remember, because it was around the end of shutdown, I believe.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
What about you? When did you see it when it came out, or did it take you a little bit?
I think I saw it when it came out. I mean, there was so much hype around this movie. And since it was lockdown and we were in especially being in Colorado, in the Boulder area, where like Colorado took it very seriously. Denver and the Boulder metro areas took it very seriously. Like, I was TAing from home. So I don't think I stepped in a classroom until I showed up to Indiana University. That's not true. I did TA in person my last semester, spring 2022. Yeah, so in person, but I definitely watched it when it first came out. I remember being learning that there was a Comanche version. I was bummed that it was dubbed.
Yes. Yes. Same. I had hoped that it would actually be the other way around.
Yes.
Yeah.
I did too. Because like, it takes away from it. Like, it was really cool that they got them all to do it in Comanche. Like, fantastic. I know like the Navajo Nation gets plenty of, they're able to dub over famous movies. I think one of the first ones was Star Wars: A New Hope, and like that went nuts.
Cherokee Nation has a version of, I think it's either just The Hobbit or the Lord of the Rings series coming out in Cherokee. It's very exciting.
That is very exciting. That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
And so I just remember complaining about that. But overall, I remember, and a big point of this film, right? Like, these are the Comanches. Most people became more familiar with the Comanches, I think, because of the book Comanche Empire by that like Swedish guy. Mm-hmm. And where he talks all about Comanches, and then some of the more, who's the guy that does like Yellowstone and the producer?
Oh, I'm terrible with names.
Or Taylor something.
Sheridan.
Taylor Sheridan. Yeah. So in some of those Westerns, those neo-Westerns of Taylor Sheridan's, the Comanches pop up. Like Come Hell or High Water, one of the Texas Rangers is Comanche. And they also feature, I think, the Comanche Casino or something like that. But back in the olden days, people talk about how fierce Comanches were. You weren't with us when I was talking with, who was I talking to? It's like Adrian Sparta, the horse chief. Oh, yeah. When I was up at Denimbrog, it was like me, Desadu Matt, and Desadu Adrian. And we're like chatting about stuff. And the Comanches came up, and like Desadu Adrian was like, I don't know why people thought Comanches were so tough. Like, we used to go, like, our children used to learn how to steal horses from the Comanche. Like, that's how like entry level they were. That's how Pawnees, that's where you learn to steal horses, is we'd send our kids out to go raid Comanche horses. And the Comanches wouldn't mess with them. They're just like, just let them. We don't want the smoke. Just let them take it.
I think that says more about Pawnees than it does about anyone else, because here in South Central Oklahoma, Comanches were feared and loathed, particularly after removal brought many of the tribes from the southeast into Indian territory, because they were constantly stealing horses, not just from Chickasaw and Choctaw nations, but sometimes ranging out as far north as like Muscogee Nation. Like it was, they definitely made their presence known.
Probably because we were stealing all their horses. They had to go take everyone else's horses.
Who can say?
The cycle continues. And so we were cracking up about it because they're like, Comanche this, Comanche that. And a lot of it's that book. And I remember one of the, you know, talking with cousins and my younger brother, where he, you know, people were just getting frustrated because, and where I'm trying to go with this is people know the Comanches from being from Texas and from like Eastern New Mexico, Western Oklahoma. Right. And here's a movie that's set in 1717, early 1700s, where the Comanche are in like Montana.
Right.
And the people were very confused by this. And if you know anything about Plains history, the Comanches are Shoshone speaking people. They're incredibly related to the Shoshone. They have like a language thing every year. Like the Shoshones and Comanches have a visitation where they meet up.
That's beautiful.
And the Comanches got to the Plains like pretty late, like just as Shoshone and people got access to horses in the 1500s. The Comanches split off from the Shoshones and went down to where we know of them today and started causing all sorts of hell. But that's my little Plains fun fact, because there's no like archaeological record of Comanches. They're Shoshonean people. And you don't really start saying what we'd call Shoshone archaeology until there's horses and they're so mobile. And in the Western Plains, it's just impossible to find, like unless it's stone circles, you're not finding a Comanche site.
Your favorite stone circles.
Stone circles. To some people, always sacred. Can never be changed. Can't take pictures, nothing. But that's just how it goes. But what were some of the main themes that you noticed from this movie or things that you enjoyed about it?
So you talked about like other Western films. I think one of the great things about Prey is it really kind of takes the model of a Western as both a coming of age story as well as this like adventure journey and really like plays within those stereotypes very well. I think there's some similarities between Prey and films like True Grit, which I, whether it be the Coen brothers version or the much more well-known John Wayne version from the 70s, in that it centers not only a female hero, but a very young hero that perhaps does not have all of the skills that she might need in the wilderness, and yet continues to survive, continues to learn, and eventually meets her goal. So what's great about Naru is we watch her sort of struggle with her own inner self, and as much as she's struggling with the predator, right? Like the predator is introduced to us relatively early on as the big threat, but yet her ability just to keep herself from falling in the swamp or making sure that she's able to catch enough dinner to stay fed and to feed her dog is absolutely as much of the problem of the central problem of the story. And by the end of the film, not only does she help solve several existential threats for her people, she's able to rely on herself and her own ability to survive.
Excellent. And with that, we're going to go ahead and take our first break. We'll be right back after these messages. And welcome back to episode 31 of the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. We are still here with Miss Jacqueline Sparks. And so Naru, who you mentioned at the end of that last section, that is the name of the main protagonist. I don't think we actually like covered that. And so Naru is who we follow, and their dog, who's like looks, I think it's a Carolina dog, which allegedly may or may not have Amerindian Indian dog ancestry. I was like looking up articles on it, and like the jury's still out if it's actually like a native dog or not. But it's like dingo-ish-esque. Fine.
We totally had dogs. It's just it may or may not be this dog, right? Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
okay, just to be clear on that.
Yes. Yeah. Parvo was to Amerindian dogs as smallpox was to Amerindians. Like, Parvo wiped out most dogs in the Americas. Really sad. But it may or may not, the Carolina dogs may or may not have some sort of native ancestry to the continent. Who can say? Geneticists. Where was I going with that? And so that dog makes a is pretty, I wouldn't say critical, but.
Yeah, I would say Sari has a prominent role in the plot, not only as a companion for Naru, but also as kind of this comic foil to some extent. I mean, there's no like gags with the dog, right? But like there's this dynamic where they're having these unspoken interchanges, especially in the early days of the film where she's like trying to feed both of them and she's offering large amounts of her food to Sari. And then there's that great moment when she gets injured, when she's out with her brothers and she gives Sari half of the fish from that fell from the, what was it? Like the hawk or whatever.
Yeah. Or the eagle. Her brother shot something out of the sky, raptor of sorts.
Yeah.
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 And so one thing that was kind of weird about the movie though, is like when you look at the makeup of the Comanches, it's like young adults, and then old people. Like there's no like middle people in their 30s. It doesn't look like you have like a bunch of old guys and then like young men.
Well, and it's also a very solitary existence, right? Like there's no other signs of other tribal contact or captives or trade, any kind of interchange that would have been a normal part of life. We have the Comanches in their singular town. We have the French fur traders and their whole crew. And then we have the predator. And although like, it's kind of nice to have this like tight triangle within the story, at the same time, when we pull back a little bit, it seems to be missing some key parts.
Yeah. I mean, and I think there was like more, you see more French trappers on screen than I think you do Comanches. Like, I think there was like a handful of lodges. Like, it is an awfully small Comanche settlement for what appears to be like a summertime.
Yeah.
Like, Comanches should be out there hunting bison pretty heavily. And it's just this small little group up there in the mountains.
Right.
It is peculiar. But, I mean, like, you can't have a predator movie in the snow. It just wouldn't work for how the predator does its thing. But yeah, it's awfully small settlement for Comanches at this time period. And they mention they know what horses are, but like you don't see any horses in their camp.
Right. And I mean, that's not, I don't know. I would say that's not entirely surprising, but actually it is surprising because like you said, it's 1713. Mm-hmm. So it's absolutely surprising by that late date.
Yeah. And like, I guess they could be pasturing somewhere else, but like clearly because her brother at one point is like, oh, I need to get myself a horse. And when he gets on it, he's riding it and is able to fight off. It's like, clearly they know what horses are and know what's going on. But just like little quirks like that. Not that you see the village much or the town. I would say village in this instance, because there's like seven lodges, the camp, you can say. And it's curious as to why. Maybe it's not necessarily curious, but like the predator goes after Trapper's camp and doesn't seem to interact at all. Well, it doesn't interact at all with the Comanche camp. I mean, Naru has to show up, you know, spoiler alert, at the end with its head.
Right.
And be like, we have to leave. And,
maybe the predator had a bad run in with some Pawnees that had all the horses.
I don't know. I mean, the Pawnees would have just dipped the fuck out. Come walking in, come riding home. They would have been gone. But I thought it was neat because I guess you could kind of explain it. It's the predator is the reason why the Comanches went off to the plains. But we know by 1719 or whatever this movie's supposed to take place, Comanches are already on the southern Great Plains. So, like, what's happening?
Right. It sounds like maybe the writer's room just didn't do all the research. I think it's one of those things where they wanted to have the fur trappers as the threat and to have this like critical interaction. And it's like, it kind of leverages against itself, right? Like which is the greater existential threat, the fur trappers or the predator? And at the end of the day towards the end of the movie, Naru has this really chilling interaction with a Métis person who has, you know, some cultural understanding of who she is. He has this beautiful quill work bandolier sash and, you know, clearly had some kind of cultural connection to his own people at one time, but has been living in filth with these European fur trappers. And he attempts to barter with Naru to save his own life. And in the end, he dies at the hands of the predator because the predator steps on him. And when he reels up to defend himself, that's when the predator finally kills him. But he caused a distraction that gave Naru a chance to escape one more time.
Yeah. So you think that guy was native?
Yeah. I think he's supposed to be a Métis First Nations person, which, we all tribal nations kind of have this history of having people who acted as translators, perhaps became culturally acclimated to European or American groups that they were living among, and, you know, may have worked against other indigenous peoples.
Fair enough. Yeah, I can't like quite fit him. He does come across as like mixed or something, but like definitely much more filthy. Like his teeth are much more visibly yellow, and he just looks disheveled,
right?
And not like he's having a great time. And yeah. Also like the French, and I mentioned this on, and I don't want to get too much into it because I don't want to like, please watch or listen to the screens of the Stone Age episode. Like me and Jacqueline are just kind of going down our own like tangents that weren't necessarily covered. But like, it was odd to me that the French would have been this far up the Missouri River in force by this time. Like that's a much more later kind of deal. Like they're still doing just fine out in the Hudson Bay, out in the lower Missouri River region.
Right.
They hadn't totally wiped out the bison out east or all the beavers in the Mississippi yet. So.
Right. R.I.P. to the beavers.
R.I.P. to the beavers.
That cornerstone species.
I know. What was the name of that artist, Chief Lady Testicle? What's their?
Kent Monkman.
Kent Monkman. Kent Monkman. What's the name of that beaver?
The beaver painting that made beaver us painting. Both that made us both cry.
Fuck yeah, the King's Beavers. That's what it's called. Yeah. You have a chance. That's heartbreaking. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it's the little ghost beavers too. So yeah. For the audience at home that is perhaps not as familiar with Kent Monkman's work as we are, Kent created this beautiful history painting of Canadian Mounties harassing the First Nations people on the shore. And at the same time, these First Nations people are complicit in exterminating the beavers for their pelts. And there's these like little spirit beavers that are going up to the sky in the painting. And it's both this sumptuous historic history painting while also just being absolutely heartbreaking.
Yeah, like there's a beaver with a rosary praying to God. It's not great. It's really sad. Like really sad. Kent Monkman has some great work.
Yeah. And of course, beavers are important to the ecology of most of North America because they not only create their beautiful dams, but those dams act as filters that make sure that other pollutants and debris don't impede the river. They're just kind of part of the circle of life there at all of these wonderful streams.
Now I'm going down a rabbit hole like Kent Monkman stuff.
Naru fights off a grizzly thanks to a beaver's dam, just to tie that in.
That is true. Well, the predator does most of the heavy lifting there. The beaver's dam just protects Naru enough time for the predator to show up. Right. So like part of like this is the first time like Naru's coming across it, right? Like early on, she's hunting that deer with her chipstone axe, which is bonkers. The predator ship coming to the atmosphere spooks the deer. The predators, you know, one of their main missions is like they're on their own eat, pray, love journey, but it's with killing people and getting spines to get their own adulthood. Like they kill the rattlesnake and then they move towards kills the wolf. And then lastly, it's that grizzly bear, which is chasing the main character, our protagonist. Right. And like he's able to like lift it up over its head. And it was a wild scene. And it's like showing accuracy and precision and like the strength of the predator itself, and that it's a formidable beast. And throughout the whole movie, she's like the only one that's able to get away repeatedly, except for she gets a break by getting caught in that trap. And when she's trapped, the predator, it'd be unsportsman for the predator to kill her. So it leaves her alone and allows her to get taken by the French. So then the predator can then start going after the French more intensively.
Right. You had some big feelings about that chipstone axe too.
Yeah. I mean, like, you wouldn't have sharpened it that way. It would have snapped a million times the way they were using it. Like, they show one of the brothers with like a groundstone axe. That would have been much better.
And again, this is 1713. Like, trade goods exist widely.
Yeah, they do. And I don't think they showed any of the Comanche at that point with metal tools at all.
No, or pots or anything like that. No, it was basically a pre-contact camp.
But they knew about horses.
Correct.
I mean, like, yeah, depending on where you are, right? I mean, like, it took, you can't really radiocarbon date pots, but I mean, it's not like these groups were actively purchasing cutlery and cookery from European powers at this point. A lot of it was just raided, but yeah, you would have expected to see something, at least trade cloth. Something like Hudson Bay trade cloth.
Just sprinklings. Like, I'm not saying that would have been the majority, but like at this point, especially if they were raiding and dealing with horses in any regard, you would expect little bits of belt buckles and iron hatchets and things like that.
Yeah, something would have shown up. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Just a real quick review, thoughts and feelings about Prey 2022. I'll put a link to Screens of the Stone Age podcast in the comments below. Any last thoughts, Jacqueline, for the listeners?
No, thank you for having me. Even though we have a few critiques, it's still one of my favorite movies.
It's a great movie. All right, everyone, we will catch you next time. We'll be back. We'll have Dr. Nikki Klarman, the State Archaeologist of Kansas, Amy Gillespie to talk about Jones Miller, and we got some more people. We're going to have a lot of guests coming up soon ahead of the holiday season. So we will see you next time. Toodaloo.
Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarcpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.